This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. Last month, the government set out its strategy for mending what it called the broken housing market. In this episode, we ask what broke it and why it matters. The government has called the housing market broken. There are many striking statistics illustrating that brokenness, but you can't do graphs on the radio unless you're Neil Rozelle, the father of the BBC radio audiographic. Here he is.
Say a couple on low to middle income is saving for a house. They're able to put aside 5% of their wages. Each coin drop represents 1 year they'd have to save for an average-sized deposit. In the 1990s, it took... The couple would have to save for 3 years before they could throw a housewarming party in their first home. What about today? Remember, each coin drop is a year of saving. Today, it'd take a couple 24 years to save for an average house deposit. A couple starting in their late 20s could look forward to throwing their housewarming party in their 50s.
Well done.
That's buying. It's also getting tougher for people who are renting. Nearly 1 million more households with children rent privately than a decade ago, and they pay more in housing costs than those who own their own home. Housing costs in general for those under the age of 44 have grown twice as fast as incomes in the last 10 years. How has this happened and why does it matter? In a moment, I'll be joined in the briefing room by a panel of experts to find out just what is happening. But first, I've been to Bristol, which has experienced some of the fastest rising prices in Europe in recent years, to see what effect the housing dearth is having there. The population of Bristol is growing. The city's coffee shops seem to be keeping pace, but not the housing market. There were just 900 additional homes added to the city's housing stock last year, but around 8,000 new residents. Among those moving here last summer was 28-year-old marketing professional George Swindale and his girlfriend. Over a cappuccino, he tells me that since arriving, it's become clear that buying their first home is far more difficult than they'd imagined.
Well, at the moment, you know, we're paying quite a lot of money for rent. We're almost 30 years old. We're both working professionals. It feels like the right time to get onto the housing ladder. And the more I looked into it, the more and more kind of anxious I got about house prices rising every year. You know, you can watch property programs that are repeated from a couple of years ago, and I think if that was me, I would have snapped it up straight away, because I know that the value of that has gone up by 30%. So I'm anxious to get on with it as soon as I can, because, you know, the high rents in this area especially mean that it's hard to save up.
The kind of image that comes to my mind is a bit like that guy who has to roll that stone up the hill. It gets more and more difficult.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
Tell me, when you were a student, when you were younger, did you imagine this is how it would be?
No, I didn't, to be honest. I never thought that the house prices would spiral out of control like they have been doing in recent years.
Its popularity with people like George means Bristol has seen annual price rises outstrip even London. Houses went up in value by more than 12% in the year to October 2016. George and his girlfriend, then, are stuck renting privately for the time being. But that means that young professionals are, in effect, pushing up rents for lower-income families.
We brought you here to make it real, really, to show you a place where we're building council housing, but also, you know, we're also building...
That's Councillor Paul Smith, the Cabinet Lead for Homes and Communities with Bristol City Council. And we're at the site of some new council houses they're building in the north of the city.
Would you describe to me first what the situation is in Bristol in terms of housing need and the problem of meeting it?
We've got fewer and fewer homes that are at what might be at the lower end of the market that allow people to buy. We've got quite a lot of homes that are quite expensive. The average house price in Bristol is £260,000. The average wage is a tenth of that. Rents are rising dramatically within Bristol. The average private rent is £1,000 a month. And we're finding a large number of people are being moved on from their private rented accommodation, because the landlord can double the rent if it moves from housing people on low incomes on housing benefit to young professionals. And Bristol's a really attractive place. It's got two very good universities, got a very high stay-on rate. So what we've got is people at the bottom of the housing market are just not getting anywhere. And there's been a failure to build affordable housing in the city. And so it falls upon us to try and bridge that gap. And we're investing close to £100 million over the next 5 years in social housing and council housing, like the new housing that we've got here, to try and do our best to bridge that gap. But we always feel that we're playing catch-up.
But it gets worse even than that. The city is building more social housing, but its stock is still declining. Why? Because of the revival of an old policy from the Thatcher era, the right to buy. Tenants can buy the socially rented sector home they live in, often for much less than its market value, and they're buying them faster than the city can build them.
At the moment, we're building 50 council homes a year. Through the right to buy, we're still selling 200 a year, so we're not even keeping up with the sales. We estimate within 10 years, half of these properties will be sold. So of the 20 we're building today on this estate, 10 of them will be in private ownership. Some of them then may become private rented, and we might actually find that they're being rented out again at three times what we're renting them out at.
So actually what you're looking at is a situation here. You are going to put people who don't have such high incomes into these houses for rent. Half of them will then be sold, and some of those will then come up in the private rented sector, but only rented to people who have greater means than the people who start in them.
Unfortunately, that's very much the case, that we're seeing increasingly council housing that's been bought, then being bought up by private landlords, and then being rented out at far higher, two to three times the rent that the council would charge, which obviously puts pressure on the finances, both of the people living there, but also the government in terms of housing benefit. If the people who are coming in are on housing benefit, the government would be paying a lot more for them to be in the private rented sector than they would if they were on housing benefit in the council housing sector.
That's really interesting. So now tell me, if you were to kind of rank them, what are the biggest problems for you in getting new build done?
Firstly is capacity for us as a local authority to have enough people to do the land deals, to get the planning permissions through, to do the legals, because local authorities... Bristol's been cut by a quarter, it's now being cut by another quarter. Very often what's happened in the past is those less visible services are the ones that have reduced.
Sorry, can I just ask you that? You mean you don't really have the staff to get the stuff going?
We certainly didn't. We've actually decided, despite our budgetary problems, to invest an extra £1.5 million of revenue in employing staff to get housing schemes through the system.
So that was number one.
Mm-hmm. Number two is obviously the difficulty of urban sites. They're more expensive to develop than if you've just got a greenfield site. So we've got contamination, we've got problems of access, we've obviously, every site has got neighbours. So there's a lot more work to do to bring those sites forward.
And number three?
We do have a problem in the private sector that people buy land probably for more than they should, and therefore they go through the process of getting planning permission. That triples the value of the land. They sell it on. They don't have to build any houses to make a big profit. Then somebody else realises they bought it for too much. Then they can't afford to build any housing on it. So they sit on it waiting for the land value to rise. And then they've got the choice again of, do they go through all that trouble of actually building stuff, or do they just sell the land to somebody else?
Paul Smith has had the housing brief since last May, when Labour took control of the council in Bristol. Fixing housing was an important promise to the voters, and they have a job on their hands.
Our ambition is to get to at least building 2,000 homes per year in Bristol, of which 800 would be affordable. And in a sense, all we'll be doing, if we get to that, which is seen as a very ambitious target...
Because you're building how many now?
Well, last year, in the whole of Bristol, 900 were built, and only about 150 were affordable. With the 800, we'll be starting to chip away at the backlog of need, but really, we need quite significantly more.
You heard would-be homebuyer George Swindale and Councillor Paul Smith, the Cabinet Member for Homes at Bristol City Council. So what exactly is the housing crisis in Britain and what caused it? Joining me now in the briefing room to explain it to me are the economist Dame Kate Barker, who led two major policy reviews for the government in the noughties on housing supply and on land use planning. She also sits on the board of the house builder Taylor Wimpey as a non-executive director. Lindsay Judge is a senior research and policy analyst leading on housing for the think tank The Resolution Foundation. And Emma Meyer is editor of the industry trade magazine Inside Housing. Kate Barker, if I could begin with you. You looked at the issue of housing supply for the government. So a nice, simple question to begin with. Do we have enough homes in this country?
When people are talking about this, they generally start off by looking at what the Office for National Statistics thinks is going to be the number of households that will form, will want to go and live somewhere based on previous trends. And they think that's over 200,000 a year. But if you look back at what's happened over the last 10 years, we've only built in England about 166,000. So there's really quite a big gap, about 50,000 plus a year. So then you think, hey, 50,000 households a year for 10 years, that's a lot of households. It's in fact 500,000 households. So where are they all? And the answer is that you're seeing signs of strain in the housing stock. We're seeing increasing homelessness, a little bit of overcrowding in the social rented sector. The other thing that's happened is we have actually been successful, this is good news, in bringing long-term empty homes back into the stock. And the third thing, of course, is a lot more young people are living at home than 10 years ago. When they've left university, they go back home. Now, those trends can't continue. We can't continue to fix the gap between what we're building and the households that are coming along by those means. So unless we start to build more very soon, then we'll find these cracks, this crisis will get worse.
And can I just delve a little bit further into this? When you talked about that shortage, that global shortage, and that eventual 500,000, is there a shortage everywhere? How is it distributed?
Well, a simple answer is that it is worse in London and what we might think of as the London hinterland, broadly the sort of southeast, although places like Bristol do, of course, have their own problems, as indeed do many places in the north. There are areas around Leeds where house prices are rising very rapidly, anywhere really where the economy is very vibrant. But it is important to think it isn't really everywhere. If you were to look at the northeast as a region, on average, house prices there haven't yet got back to their peak ahead of the financial crisis. So the problem is not the same everywhere, although you'll find elements of it everywhere. The problem that was discussed very graphically at the beginning of the programme, difficulty for young families in finding their deposits, is quite a challenge everywhere because the need for a deposit has risen so much since the financial crisis. because, rightly, lenders are much more cautious about how they lend.
Lindsay Judge, one of the things that you hear is that an aspect of why the market doesn't work in the way you might expect the work market to do is that because it is dominated by a few very large developers, and it's impossible for more competitive smaller developers to come in and make the market operate more efficiently. Do you think that's true?
Well, the housing market is a very volatile market, so it has its ups and downs. And what we see is that during the downturns, the large developers suffer, for sure, but they tend to weather the storm, and it's the smaller builders who drop out of the market, who go to the wall. And when things pick up again, quite often a lot of those small builders don't come back into the market, perhaps for understandable reasons. So we have a kind of resetting of the economy, the housing economy, at a lower level each time. And that has real implications. I mean, the practical implication is, for example, a larger developer may not want to build on smaller sites. So there may be lots of small chinks of land around the country where the larger developers are not keen to develop. But also, of course, you have fewer actors in the market, and that potentially stifles competition and innovation.
Let's expand the question to the private rented sector as well. Why are we unable to supply sufficient private rented places for demand?
Well, that's an interesting assertion. I'm not sure I'd actually agree with that. I think if you Well, if you look at the English Housing Survey, there's new statistics out today, and the tenure trends there are quite clear. We've seen declining home ownership in the UK over the last 20 years or so, and we've seen a decline in the social rented sector. And in a sense, the private rented sector has stepped into the breach. So 20 years ago, around about 1 in 10 households lived in the private rented sector. Today, it's 1 in 5, so it's doubled over the time. So in fact, we've got an expanding private rented sector, and if you like, it's sort of taking up the slack over time.
I suppose I meant affordable private rented sector, which is one of the things which you always kind of forget to throw into the discussions at this point when you're talking numbers. You have a very, very peculiar notion of affordable. And actually, maybe we should define what affordable means, Kate Barker.
Well, I think that's incredibly, incredibly difficult. I mean, I'm always struck by the fact that people say, well, developers should only build affordable homes. But of course, we do only build homes that people can buy. So they are affordable to somebody. I think by affordable, what you're talking about is a household who will struggle to meet the market price without spending a very large proportion of their income on it. So there are, I think, over 2 million households in the UK who have to spend, who are below average and have to spend more than a third of their income on rents. It's people in the rented sector who are really struggling. Once people, if people are able to raise a deposit and move into the housing market, actually mortgage payments are pretty affordable for most people. And it is now the people in the private rented sector who are struggling. But as Lindsay said, I don't think that's because there's a sort of special problem of undersupply in the private rented sector. It's just that when you've got undersupply, you have to see the symptoms of it somewhere. And the private rented sector is where the symptoms are appearing pretty acutely at the moment.
Is that because of the knockdown that we saw in Bristol, which is that slightly wealthier people who are not buying homes, they haven't yet got to the deposit level, are getting into the private rented sector, where landlords therefore find that they can get more money from them than from, or they find themselves competing with families on lower incomes?
Yes, it's the problem that if you have an overall lack of supply, somebody is going to get squeezed out. And at the moment, it's less well-off families trying to get into the private rented sector, which, by the way, often if you're less well-off, not only is expensive for you, but often badly maintained and not terribly well regulated.
Lindsay Judge, you've been analysing almost precisely this point. What is your research show about the affordability of housing over the past 20 years across the piece?
Well, it's shown that affordability has decreased over time. So if we look at the proportion of the number of families who are spending more than a third of their income on their housing costs, which is considered the threshold of unaffordability, we see that 20 years ago, 1 out of 14 households did that. Today, it's closer to 1 in 6. So the problem has definitely got worse.
Right. Now, Emma, I was just about to bring you in, and you've indicated you want to come in at that point. So the last 10 years has seen fall in home ownership and an equally dramatic rise that we've been talking about in the private rental sector. The funny thing is that's seen as a bad thing in Britain. And we use this phrase, don't we, generation rent, as if that was somehow dreadful. Why are we like this about it? They're not like that abroad.
I suppose perhaps some of the controversy about that phrase is partly that it was a phrase which was adopted to describe people who wanted to buy their own home. After all, the vast majority of people in the UK do want to own their own home, but simply couldn't afford to do so. And the government, perhaps a bit disingenuously, tried to sort of claim that phrase and tried to imply that perhaps it described people who were just early on in their careers, who valued the flexibility that comes from renting, and actually it was a lifestyle choice that they wanted to be renting. And while there certainly are people for whom that is the case, I think it's pretty clear that that doesn't accurately describe the majority of people who are in that circumstance.
No, it's perfectly described by a man in Bristol, George Swindell, who obviously regarded every penny that he spent on the rented sector as effectively money down the drain and money wasted. And we've all heard this as a kind of expression. And yet we know that in other countries, Germany is always held up as a kind of example of this. It is regarded as perfectly sensible to rent and not as some kind of great loss. So I'm just wondering why it is that our perception has become so skewed as to between renting and buying, Kate Barker.
Well, I suppose there are a couple of very obvious reasons why people might prefer owning to renting in the UK. One of them is that over most of the past, and by the way, I don't think this necessarily will continue into the future, house prices have risen pretty strongly. So people see it as a good way for them to improve their housing wealth. You're allowed to borrow quite a lot against a house. You know, nobody will let you borrow a lot of money to speculate in the stock market, but they'll let you borrow a lot of money to speculate in the housing market. It's a curious feature. And the second thing is that we have very different position as far as the position of tenants is concerned in the UK. I talked about poor maintenance, but it's also true that we tend to have relatively short tenancies and a little bit less protection for tenants. Now, that's made the market very vibrant. Landlords are keen to go into it, but it also means that for the tenants themselves, it's less attractive.
Lindsay, let's talk about the social impact of these patterns, which is something that you've done quite a lot of work on. What does this do to us?
Well, I think it does something in the here and now, and it does something potentially in the future. So in the here and now, if you're spending more of your income on housing costs, then clearly you have less for other consumption goods. So it matters in that respect. It certainly matters, I think, as Kate and Emma have intimated, that home ownership is seen as a badge of success in the UK. And so people who don't get to own their own homes perhaps feel differently about themselves than they would in the past. So that's the impacts in the here and now. Longer term, there's real implications if these tenure trends continue into the future for people into retirement. And that's both true for themselves, but also, of course, for the state. In your Bristol package, somebody mentioned housing benefit. If people don't own their own homes in the future, what does that mean for our housing benefit bill going forward?
Mama.
I think also it's worth just looking at some of the reasons behind this. You know, the private rented sector is growing sort of at the expense of home ownership and social rent. And that's because some of the things that we've talked about already, the right to buy sees a lot of homes moving into the private rented sector. We did a piece of research last year and worked out that about 40% of the homes that have been sold through right to buy during the duration of that policy are now in the private rented sector. Near where I live in Milton Keynes, it's 70% of those properties are in the private rented sector. And likewise, on the other side, you've got people who perhaps have got a little bit of extra money to invest, and they see the housing market as a really good place to invest. And they see that as an alternative to or a better version of a pension plan. And of course, they're thinking about their future needs, they're thinking about inheritance, they're thinking about care costs in the future and that sort of thing. So that's sort of creating a scenario where you've got a huge number of landlords who actually have one or two properties or a relatively small portfolio of properties. And that's very different to having a sort of a highly professionalised private rented sector where you've got perhaps institutional investors who own a lot of properties and who rent out in a slightly different way, probably on longer tenancies, and which sort of has the potential perhaps to solve some of these things.
Kate Barker, you warned in your review on housing supply that a shortage of new homes would increase inequalities specifically. Is that what you believe has happened in the 10 years since then?
Absolutely. We've talked about the problems for people who haven't been able to buy and have got stuck in the private rented sector and having to pay a lot of money and really can't move towards home ownership. I think those are people who are struggling. But more fundamentally, of course, we've got this generational problem. So people like me who are older and bought a house quite some time ago, we've seen a big rise in the value of that house. And that means that we are better off than our children, who, of course, are looking, if they're looking to buy houses, will find it more difficult. But it's not just intergenerational, it's also across the generation. So if you are lucky enough to be the child of somebody who owns a home and has a lot of housing equity, they can probably help you with a deposit. If you happen to be the child of somebody who didn't, your chances of raising that deposit and owning a home are much less. And I think that's a really big problem, because if that went on generation to generation, it would solidify a big divide between property owners and non-property owners. I'd be very unhappy to see that.
I see. So essentially, it has deepened inequality, is what you're saying. It's not just, I mean, there always was, of course, a degree of inequality. People were richer than other people. What you're saying is, actually, in an era when we wanted to deal with inequality, the housing situation and housing inheritance and so on makes that worse.
It certainly makes the distribution of wealth worse. In some ways, actually, of course, greater home ownership and rising house prices meant more people have had an asset, but the gap between them and the people who don't have an asset has got more acute. The way in which, of course, government could seek to solve this problem was if it sought to tax more effectively the rise in property values that people have experienced. The trouble is there are only two ways of doing this. One is that you make council tax much more related to property value, i.e. you have to pay more if your property is worth more, or you have to tax houses, the gain you've made on a house when you sell it, you have to introduce capital gains tax. Both of those are very complicated, and both of them would be very unpopular. So I wouldn't expect that to happen tomorrow.
Lindsay Judge, your foundation has been very, very much involved both in inequality discussions generally and in generational inequality. Is generational... I know a lot of people of my age who don't really think that generational inequality is a thing in terms of the housing market. We've got our houses and we're going to pass them on to the next generation. And where's the problem? Perhaps you could explain why it is that you think that generational inequality is a much bigger problem maybe than people realise in terms of the housing market.
Well, just to give you one set of statistics, if we look at the baby boomers, over 60% of baby boomers owned a house by the time they were 30. Now, today's millennials, only just around about 40% own by that age. So there's clearly a different experience going on in the housing market. And as we've discussed already, that has significant implications into the future in terms of wealth. Now, the big, I think, open question is whether inheritance is going to probably not solve that problem, but perhaps unravel that problem to some extent. But only time will tell on that one.
You think it's possible that it might?
I think it's possible that it will help some, but as Kate says, the question then becomes, to what extent does it entrench already existing inequalities?
Yeah, so actually, even if we deal with generational inequality, the problem will be is that we get a greater social inequality.
We may get a greater split.
Kate Barker, what is it that we would need to do? If we were to try to get to the situation whereby we don't have this sort of great 500,000 loss, are we mostly in the business of just building more stuff in more places where it's wanted? Is that essentially, and at the end of the day, what we've got to do?
If we want to meet the probable demand for homes, and I'm using the word demand deliberately, not need. When you talk about need, I think you're talking about people who are at the bottom of the ladder. Of course, as people get richer, they tend to want more space and they want second homes. And unless you're going to stop them having that, then I think you have to talk about meeting demand as well as meeting need. Then I think in order to do that, you will have to build more homes and you will have to build them around where demand is. Now, we may wish to spread demand around the country, and I think that would be a great thing, but you can't just do it by building houses in different places. But I think I would also say that when you're talking about these problems of inequality and rising cost in the housing system, you cannot solve that just by building more. That also reflects the big change we have seen, of course, in financial conditions in the UK over the last 10 or 15 years, which is proving to be very long-lasting, i.e. we've got low interest rates.
Well, thank you very much. That's it for this week. In another briefing room, we'll tackle the problems of what to do about the housing crisis. In the meantime, my thanks to Paul Smith and George Swindale in Bristol, and to Dame Kate Barker, policy analyst Lindsay Judge, and Inside Housing editor Emma Meyer. We're closing the briefing room door for a month. Come back and be briefed in April. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. My producer for this episode was Phil Kemp. The sound engineer was Rod Farker. Research was by Sam Bright. If you're looking for other quality podcasts to listen to, subscribe to a new series called Intrigue, Murder in the Lucky Holiday Hotel. It's the story of a mysterious killing that changed the course of Chinese politics, and it's based on an investigation by the BBC's China editor, Carrie Gracie. Just search for Murder in the Lucky Holiday Hotel, BBC. And if you'd like to let us know what you think about the series, there's an easy way to do it. Just write a review or ratings on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.